Today's date is December 3rd, 2016, and I am here with Leslie Edwards, the archivist of Cranbrook. And my name is Allie Penn, and we are going to get started. So, Leslie, where were you raised, and what was your family like?
Well, I was born in Middletown, New York, and my father died when I was young, about 18 months old, and my mother, who was from Detroit, had a decision to make. Was she going to stay in New York or move back to Detroit where her family was from? And that's what she did. So we lived in Detroit at like Southfield and Joy Road for about 5 years until my mom remarried, and then we moved out to Birmingham. So I was raised basically in Birmingham.
All right. And when did you know you were gay?
That's a tough question, because when I was a kid, no one talked about being gay. The word lesbian was like a foreign land. Never heard it, even heard the word. There was no Oprah or Phil Donahue talking about gay issues, gay communities. You know, I had crushes on teachers, even in grade school, I can remember. I went to a summer camp. I had crushes on girls, but I didn't know at the time it was a crush. I didn't know really what it was. I just liked them. So probably it wasn't until college that I started really understanding what these feelings were and what that meant. I had a friend. There was a group of us. There were six of us, and we had apartments across the hall from each other. And so this one friend, we ended up just having a relationship, and that was my first girlfriend. And I worked at Claire's train station in Lansing, Michigan, and had some coworkers, a gay boy and a woman who was bisexual, and they took me to my first gay bar.
And what was that like?
Joe Cavello's. It was scary, because it was exciting and scary at the same time. What was scary about it was that it was a dive. And you would walk in, and on the left-hand side was the bar, and on the right-hand side were all these booths where all these like old men were sitting. And you're thinking, okay, I thought this was supposed to be a women's bar, and here's all these old men. And then you walked past them and turned left, and then there were the women, and there was the dance floor. And that it was great. I mean, it was great to actually be in a space like that and to be able to dance with women. And, you know, that was the, I call it disco era. It was great.
Was there a sort of separation between the sexes?
Absolutely. The men's bar was just down the street. I forgot what it was called. I went there a couple times. It was super nice. They had these like aluminum palm trees. It was really clean. And Joe Cavello's was a dive. So it was, that was kind of interesting too. I mean, this was, you know, this was in the late 70s, and, you know, Title IX was 1976. So there was a big, you know, that was a whole, you know, difference too at that time.
So were there only the two bars in Lansing that you knew of?
There was actually a third one. I don't know if it was around for very long. I remember going to it. Maybe that was a mixed bar. I have vague memories of it. So apparently I didn't go there very much.
So what was it like coming out to your parents?
That was interesting too, because I didn't really come out to my parents. I had this girlfriend, and I was home for Christmas, and I was all kind of moping around because I missed her. And so my mother asked me, "Do you have a relationship with her?" And I started crying. "Yes, I wanted to tell you, but I was afraid to." So my mom pretty much told everybody. She told, you know, everybody, my relatives and her friend, our family friends, and so I didn't really have to come out to anybody except for my little brother. And that was scary, because I'm really close with him, and I was afraid of what he would think. I just remember it being scary. I don't remember what his comment was, but it didn't change our relationship any, so that was fine.
So were your parents really supportive then, your mom was?
I wouldn't say supportive is the word. I would say my mother certainly accepted me because I was her daughter. It took probably 6 months, really, for her to sort of come to grips. She was concerned. She said to me, you always take the hard road. She didn't want me to have, you know, a harder life. I don't think, you know, they weren't happy about it, but my mom was pretty cool. My dad, I don't even remember what his reaction was, quite frankly. My stepdad, I don't really remember, but they always accepted my partners, even if they didn't like them. They still welcomed them into their homes. My mother used to give my partners really thoughtful birthday presents. She took the time to get to know them. We went, visited them on vacations, and so it was, yeah, supportive, I guess, is a word, maybe not in the beginning, but later on, for sure.
Right.
I have not had any trouble with any family members, any of our family friends, so in that regard, I was really lucky, really lucky.
So you said that you had crushes on girls all growing up, but did you ever date guys?
I did, probably because, you know, you were supposed to.
Right.
I dated a guy in high school for a year or two. I had kind of an up and down because, you're trying to find yourself and find out what's going on, where your place is in the world. So at one time I was in this phase where I was a Jesus freak. So I would go to these religious meetings, and so that sort of affected that relationship with that guy. He was not interested in that, and so that ended, which I'm sure it would have ended anyway. And then when I went to college, I did date a couple of guys. Yeah, I did.
Was that awkward for you?
It was more like, you know, you read all these romance novels and it's supposed to be all these like bells go off and oh,
and the hearts in the air.
And I was thinking, are you kidding me? This is what everybody's all la 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 about? It's like there was nothing. It was like, it was almost like it was a duty that I was supposed to do. But I do want to say, The one of the things that was in the East Lansing, at least East Lansing in college, was we were able to go to concerts. They had at the Kiva, they had concerts, and it was all the women's music at the time. So it was like Teresa Trull and Chris Williamson and Holly Neer, and to go there and be in that space with just women in that intimate space, listening to women sing about women's music and women's issues. And it was just like this whole space full of, you know, a lot of lesbians, but probably not all. It was just, that was amazing. That was like where I felt finally like, this is me. This is what I want, is this feeling of being surrounded with that energy. And then everyone would start singing and the whole room swelled up with music, and I got goosebumps right now. It was just that was really something.
Just the overall acceptance of just being in that,
yeah,
space.
Yeah, and it was a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
There were no men there and it felt safe. And the same thing was true when we would go to the Women's Music Festival, which I can't remember what town it was in. It's not in the same place now. It's still going on. To go to that, and there was you didn't see a man anywhere. The only time in the whole weekend of that space where there would be men on the land is when they came to change the porta potties. And then you would hear this murmuring through across the property, because it was a campground, it was a big space. And then you would hear men on the land, men on the land. And you know, everybody was in various stages of dress and undress, and so most of the women would put their shirts back on or whatever, and then they would leave, and that was an awesome experience too, going there. I really because it felt safe. It felt safe and accepting and like, okay, this is me.
Right.
So I know I skipped a little bit, but
no problem. So what was school like for you, both high school and college?
High school was pretty awful in a lot of ways. I was kind of isolated.
It's high school.
Yeah, I was an athlete, so I did sports after school, and then I would go home and just basically go to my room, and I didn't have a group of friends that I like went to the mall or hung out with or anything. You know, college was a bit different because, you know, you go from this smaller unit to this, you know, I went to Michigan State, there were like 60,000 people on campus. So, and again, I was in sports for the first 2 years I was there, so I really hung out with that group of people. And, you know, that was a great experience. But it wasn't at the time that I was, you know, that was sort of the time I was dating guys.
What sport did you play?
I was a diver. I was a diver in the Big Ten, and that was pretty awesome. And because I was on the varsity team, we worked out with the guys' team. So, you know, we all partied together and all that stuff.
Did you face any issues being a girl sort of working with the guys' team?
No, because the coach at the time there, he had recruited women to be on the women's team. So he had this core group and they worked out together. There was a JV team who worked out with the girls' swim team. Women's swim team, the JV divers worked out with them at the women's IM, but the varsity divers worked out with the men's team. But that was interesting because, again, it was pre-Title IX. So in 1976, that was Title IX, I was offered a partial scholarship. And my coach at the time said to me, because I was a walk-on and I was not recruited, I had to try out for the team. He said, I'm only going to coach the women that I recruited because I don't get paid for coaching women. And I was like, are you kidding me? So here I had been offered this partial scholarship, and I quit diving. I quit the team. So that was a big change, because here I had been, this is what I was and what I did, and then I wasn't doing it at all. You know, we worked out 3 times a day. So that's really, I think at that point was really when I started probably really exploring more the lesbian in me, because I didn't have this other thing I was focusing on.
Was there anything you could have done to fight it, or was it sort of you have to accept it?
I don't know. I don't think I was at that time confident enough in myself to even think of that. He said, you can still be on the team, but you have to work out by yourself. And I thought, screw you, I'm not working out 3 times a day by myself with no coach. No, not doing it. So, you know, it was meant to be. So there you have it.
Right. So you described the campground and the Women's Music Festival, but you said that they were not specifically gay events.
Oh, absolutely. The Women's Music Festival was.
The Women's Festival was?
Absolutely.
Okay.
100% lesbian. Well, maybe there were a few straight girls there. I don't know.
Tagalongs.
Yeah, maybe.
The question marks.
I don't know. It was just, you camped there. Everybody worked together, so you had to have a job while you were there. So you might work in the food tent or whatever, and then there were day stages and night stages where all different kinds of women's groups, Teresa Troll, all these people would come and sing and perform. I can't think of some of the other names at the moment, but that was amazing. And you would stand in line for your food, and I met this really cool woman who lived in Chicago, and then I went to visit her in Chicago, and, you know, so it opened up, you know, some things that, you know, certainly were not on my radar.
Were there any other, like, gay groups or gay events that you participated in while you were in Lansing or Michigan?
I did. I was in a lesbian chorus I tried to find the name of it. I saw one mention of it in one of my journals, but I don't know what the name of the course was. And I know that there was a lesbian woman who led it. We sang all different kinds of songs. There was maybe 20 of us in it. And we actually went and performed. I know that we went one time to Ann Arbor, and I don't know if we sang at the Ark. We sang somewhere, I can't remember. But that was really fun. That was really fun. And then I played softball. So there were lesbian softball teams, and I coached a lesbian softball team. And so that was great. I worked at a printing place just off campus, and we did resumes and stuff for students, and everybody in the office was lesbian, so that was fun. And then we would have parties, and just to be in that space was like, I was like, wow!
Was that intentional, everyone in the office being a lesbian, or sort of?
Well, it was owned by a lesbian, so I think probably.
Okay, just a safe space for...
I don't know, just in those days, that was just like, that was sort of what growing. You could have those, you know, separation of spaces, and it wasn't politically incorrect. It was actually, you know, great.
Right. So you sort of started to describe it, but what sort of support system did you have in Lansing?
In Lansing? Just my friends, you know, or who I worked with, or... whatever. I mean, just these things that I'm describing, these different groups. You know, I mean, I was close enough to still come home, see my family. Once I went to school, I never moved back home. It was just too different, you know. Like, who wants to live at home after you experience freedom? So, you know, I would come home. We had a month off, like the month of August, we had off of school. We went back, Michigan State went back to school late, so I think the first year I came home that month. You know, I was studying, I was in art, so I was, you know, hanging out with some artists, you know. I don't know what else to say about that.
Was there any support system that you'd wish you had had? Was there anything that you felt like you were missing, or...
I have no idea what I was missing. I mean, you know, I was just like, I don't know.
Right.
I can't think of that because I was just experiencing everything.
Gotcha. So when did you move away from Lansing?
I moved in 1982. I had broken up with my first girlfriend, and I had a second girlfriend, and she had gone out to, she was in business school, and she had done a project, and she went out to San Francisco to do a school project, and she came back and she said, let's move to San Francisco. And I said, okay. So I had this little orange Horizon, which is a pretty small car. We packed the car to the gills. We had a camper shell thing, or a camper, I don't know, one of those things where you put your camping equipment and stuff on the roof. We had two bikes on the back of the car, and we drove across the country to San Francisco. But, you know, you asked me about I had some other friends. I had this friend who I knew, I knew she was a lesbian. She would never say she was. She never, still to this day, she won't use that word. But she lived in Colorado, and in Snowmass, outside of Aspen. And I would go to visit her sometimes. And one summer I went. Usually I went in the winter to ski, but one summer I went. And she played softball, and so she went to a softball tournament, and I was like, oh, softball, there has to be lesbians here. So I'm looking around, and I see this group of women sitting in the stands, and I'm like, I'm going to go talk to them. So I go over and talk to them, and some of their friends were playing. And my friend was absolutely aghast that I had gone and approached this group of women, and they and then invited us to their house, and we they had food and we cooked, and it was awesome. And the funny thing was is that my friend ended up remaining friends with those women for a long time, but that was awesome too, to just be able to, you know, and that I guess was my growing sense of self, that I was able to, and that I wanted to seek out other lesbians while I was other places. And that was sort of around that same 80s, early 80s time period. That was before I moved to San Francisco.
Gotcha. So. Sounds like they were very accepting, like the way you just described, like hanging out with, like trying to like fit into like this group of like lesbians. It seems like it's a, like an almost like acceptance like that quickly
yes.
happens.
Yes, because you were looking for other like-minded people. It was sort of be like, you know, I don't know what you would equate it to now. Maybe some ethnic group now that you're looking to find someone that you have someone in common with, that understands you and your sensibilities and yeah.
Okay. So you said that you moved out to San Francisco because of your girlfriend, and was that it? Or did she have like a job out there?
She didn't have a job. Neither of us had jobs. Which was kind of crazy, right? You're just moving to this huge city with no job. I worked in the restaurant industry, so I knew I could get a job. It wasn't a big deal. And two of my friends, actually the one woman had been my boss at the print shop in East Lansing. And she and her girlfriend had moved out to San Francisco, so I knew somebody there. So we stayed with them. So we slept on their living room floor for 2 weeks until we found an apartment and until we found jobs. So that made it a little bit easier. It's like we did know somebody.
You weren't just like blindly moving up there and being like, oh, okay, right. Here you go. So what was it like in San Francisco?
Oh, San Francisco. Well, if you think going to a softball tournament or the Women's Music Festival was great, San Francisco was like walking around with your mouth hanging open the whole time, like, oh my God, because you could be anything, anybody you wanted to be there. That was the best part of San Francisco. Didn't matter where you were. Of course, the Castro was the mecca of the gay movement, really. Lots and lots of gay men, plenty of women. There were lots of bars, different bars you could go to, different styles of bars. It was freedom to the nth degree. Nobody cared there. Nobody cared what you looked like, how you dressed, what kind of hair you had. You know, you could walk down the street holding hands with your girlfriend. It was really unbelievable. And I was in the restaurant business there, which was like, everybody in the restaurant business there is gay. I mean, pretty much, I mean, not now. And okay, that was a generalization, but it seemed like it, certainly. And certainly the places I was working at, everyone was gay.
Which job from the restaurant industry sticks with you the most from being in San Francisco?
Well, there's actually two. And they're not the ones that I had when I first went there. When I first went there, I got a job working, was I in restaurant management, working at a like a Hudson's. It was called Bullock's. And it was a restaurant within a department store. And you had to kind of dress nice. It was more of a conservative, kind of maybe Michigan, more Michigan type restaurant job. And I remember when I interviewed and they offered me the job, I said, do I have to wear a dress? Because I wasn't going to take the job if I had to wear a dress. And they said no, so I was cool with that. But then I got a job working at a pizzeria in the Castro. That was crazy. I managed the pizza place. It was very busy, very popular. It's actually still there. It's called Marcello's. And it was right on the corner in the Castro. So what I remember most about that job was Halloween, because we did delivery. We did pizza delivery. And Halloween, if you've never been to Halloween in San Francisco, it is the holiday, because it gave everyone the opportunity to just be absolutely crazy. And the whole cast, you couldn't even get across the street. It was so packed. And there would be, like, I remember this one guy was dressed up as a witch and riding a skateboard across the intersection. So it was just like that. It was just this big party and this just festive atmosphere. So that was a fun job. And then I worked at a restaurant later on in the concert district. It was called Ivy's. And it was a higher-end restaurant, and all of the staff, I was one of only two women who worked there, because in San Francisco, most of the wait staff was gay men. I don't know why. It was sexist, actually. But for some reason, it was always, whenever you went to a restaurant, the waiters were gay men. So it was really cool that I got in there, and it was really fun. It was just really fun because they were just, the guys were really fun, and we were always dissing and laughing, and they just, yeah.
So you said Castro or Castro's. What is?
Well, the Castro Street is a street. And the Castro is the district that was pretty much the gay area in the city. I mean, not that there weren't gay people all over the city, but that there's different sections of the city. Like, there's Noe Street, and there's the Mission, and there's the Embarcadero, and so the Castro was where the majority of gay events, things happened. Lots of restaurants, shops, all different kinds of things. If you watch The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, he was the mayor of the Castro. That's a great film. That was before my time, but
So we started talking about it, but what do you remember the most about the bar scene in San Francisco? Like, what sticks out to you, even though it's
been? Well, there was this women's bar called Maud's that just came to me. It was okay, but Trocadero Transfer was unbelievable. It was south of the Mission, and it was this huge, like, warehouse. I mean, it was huge. They had there were a couple different bars where you could get drinks down on the main floor, which is where the dance floor was. Then there was a sort of an upstairs where you could look down on the dance floor, and there were bars up there. And to just watch the dancing, I mean, there was fan dancing where guys would dance with fans. Just this beautiful thing. They used to have parties there because that was the time. What was that show with Dallas? Is that the one? I think it was Dallas with the women that fought each other on the
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. I can't remember their names, but so they would have Dallas parties because they had this screen, and so all of these guys would go and watch Dallas because, you know, gay men, they love all that. They loved Joan Collins, that was her name, and how she dressed and that she was this bitchy diva, and, you know, that was, you know, my friends, my group of friends, my gay men friends, they, you know, they loved that. They would dress. I had this one friend, Johnny Frisch. He was a great guy. He loved to dress up like Marilyn Monroe. So, you know, that's what I remember. That was a great bar. And the great dance music. And you would just dance and dance and dance and dance. And then now I'm on my third girlfriend, and she was a really good dancer. So we went out a lot. That was fun.
All right, so what sort of support system did you have in San Francisco?
Well, I had a group of friends, primarily from this, my third girlfriend. She had been living there for, I don't know how long, she'd been out there, maybe 4 or 5 years before I got there. And she was originally from North Carolina, and I think there were 4 or 5 of them that had all moved out to San Francisco and then made some more friends. So we were each other's family. I mean, we spent Thanksgivings together and Christmases together, and had these great dinner parties, and there's just this group we hung out with. And then I had some women friends that were separate from this group too, that I had made. This is kind of a funny story if you want to hear it. So the Russian River was a place where people would go. They had bars, and you could stay in little like cabins, or they also had a campground there. And the first weekend in May was always Women's Weekend at the River. So it was just lesbians. It was like heaven to go there. So our friends would go, and we would camp. It was these two friends that of mine from East Lansing, and then my girlfriend and I, and we would camp out. We would make these gourmet meals, and we would camp by the river, and we'd swim in the river, and it was kind of fun because during the day we'd be swimming, and we'd be swimming naked, and then these families would be in canoeing on the river, and they would come by, and their heads were just like roll because here'd be all these naked women on this beach. And anyway, it was crazy times. But we would go into the town, and we took over the whole town of Gurneyville. And still today, people talk about Women's Weekend at the River. So, and then there were these restaurants or bars. So after we had hung out during the day, we went to this bar where you could get barbecue or something, and they had this patio. And I was sitting there, and I was watching these two women together, and I just felt compelled to go and talk to them. My girlfriend's like, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to go introduce myself and talk to them." And it was a crazy thing to do. And then later on, they showed up at the restaurant where I worked at, and we are still friends to this day. I'm friends with those women. And I'm not friends with the girlfriend I had at the time. So it was, you know, anyway, that was great. So that's a different group of friends that I had that I sort of, I guess, created for myself. There was just something about them that I felt I had to go talk to them.
I mean, apparently it worked because you guys are all still friends.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting for me, and I don't know if this is true for most people, but I have sort of different groups of friends that fill sort of different areas. Like, I don't have just one best friend that, I might have a group of friends that are more art, interested in art, or more interested in philosophical and spiritual issues than, you know, like some of my oldest friends might not fit in some of those niches. They're not really interested in spiritual things, but this friend that I met was, and is. So it's kind of interesting.
Right.
So that was my support system.
All right. Now, at this time you were in San Francisco, there were a lot of misconceptions about AIDS. Did you encounter a lot of that misinformation within your friends group or within people you knew?
I wouldn't say that I encountered, well, more with my family, I would say.
Okay.
My friends, you know, I was there in the 80s, and 80s was the era of AIDS, absolutely. And my men friends, my close men friends, had AIDS. Several of them did. Some of them were HIV positive. One of them is still alive today. He doesn't know why he was spared when everybody else around us was dying. And that was interesting because it was also the time of the AIDS quilt. And so to have that be going on, and to see that the quilt came to Moscone Center, which is this big conference center, and it was laid out there, and that was really a super emotional experience to see that. I didn't go to see it in Washington, D.C., but it was unbelievable because your friends were dying around you and you could do nothing about it.
Now, what was the AIDS quilt?
The AIDS quilt was started by a guy, oh gosh, I can't think of his name right now. They had an office in the Castro, and friends and family members would make a panel in memory of someone who had died of AIDS. So initially, it grew out of the gay community in San Francisco, and then it expanded to be nationwide and include women, and not that many women, but of course, but other people who had died of AIDS that weren't just gay men. But initially, and so, you know, it might be somebody making a quilt that, you know, a panel that had whatever that person liked or was interested in. So it was a memorial quilt. I don't know where it resides currently. or if it's broken up in pieces. I know that it has been on display in other cities over the years. I don't know if it's still going on to today, but it was really something. And I had a couple friends who died. One had Kaposi sarcoma, which was the red, way worse than measles, all over his body. And he was devastated that he had it, and he didn't want to go out in public. So he shut himself in his apartment, he drew the blinds, and he watched Rocky Horror Picture Show every day till he died. My girlfriend at the time and I, we would go over to his house, and one time we, went to give him a bath, and he was embarrassed that we would be giving him a bath, and we did anyway, and we tried to get him out of the apartment, and one time he went with us, and we took him to the ocean and sat on the beach. But his family had, when he came out to his family, they basically said, "You don't exist to us," so he had no family to support him, so we were his family. And then some of my other friends died after I moved away. But yeah. So as far as misconceptions, yes, it was in the news, yes, it was rampant, but not within my group, because my group was gay. We knew what it was. We knew how it was affecting everyone's lives. At the time, Rock Hudson, I remember sitting, I went home in the summer one year, and I remember, I think it was summertime, and I remember sitting with my family, and we watched that, and my grandma was, she couldn't believe it, and, that, I remember there being some conversation about what it was, and, well, there's another story, too. When I went to the Gay Olympics, went to the Gay Games, I sat in the stands and was talking to this one guy, and he told me he was HIV positive, and I just went and I put my arm around him and gave him a hug, and he just started crying because people were afraid to touch him. He's like, "You're not afraid that you're going to get it?" And I said, "No, I mean, I don't know, it never crossed my mind to even think that was even a possibility, and I guess I didn't care anyway."
Did you witness a lot of that, though, like the people being confused about what exactly AIDS was and how they would contract it, as far as, because I mean, obviously you said that either you didn't care, or you knew that you weren't going to get it just from simply hugging a person, but
I think, I don't remember that, not in my circle. So I saw it on the news, of course, I saw it on the news. But I was, sort of in this San Francisco bubble, where, what was happening out there was not really, I don't know.
Did you see just the news reports and the blatant, don't touch people with AIDS because then you'll get AIDS? Did you see that affecting your friends that had AIDS? Obviously the guy at the Gay Games was an example, but
Right. Not so much, and maybe I was just oblivious, I can't remember it anyway. Let's put it that way.
Nope.
Maybe.
So what did you learn, just from living in the AIDS epidemic, besides, this is a terrible disease, we really need to do something? And
what did I learn? That's a tough question. Like I said, I think I wasn't really in that mindset, in retrospect. Compassion is key. And it doesn't matter what situation someone's in or what illness they might have or what they might look like, but everybody needs compassion and the human touch, to be able to hug somebody. People need hugs, no matter what they're going through, they need hugs.
All right, so you already mentioned the Gay Games. Mm-hmm. And meeting that one fellow. What else do you remember?
That was another one of those, you know, this group, this huge group of like-minded people. And I just remember, you know, the stands were packed. There were people from, I don't know if it was 27 countries or something that had come out from all over the world to compete in all these different sports. And they weren't, you know, the best athletes necessarily, but they were, you know, they were there to compete and to compete in this environment of acceptance. And so the stands were packed and there were colors. It was just really super colorful. And I know that I cried because I'm sentimental anyway. And I remember the marathon runners when they were coming in the stands at the closing ceremonies, you know, as they would run into the stadium, I was just emotional. It was just really emotional. And it was kind of this overwhelming atmosphere of, you know, like, and here, you know, sort of mind-boggling. Wow, it's not just San Francisco that's full of gay people. They're everywhere. We're everywhere. Look at how many we are in this one space. It was sort of like being in the Kiva in the, you know, in East Lansing. It was crazy in a great way.
So we can't talk about San Francisco without talking about the Gay Pride Parade.
Oh, the Gay Pride Parade. It was fabulous. Again, another one of those wow experiences. We're talking, you know, 500,000 people lining Market Street to see all these floats and people, you know, all different kinds of people. I mean, I suppose there were transgender people at the time, but that wasn't also in the news then. So there were, but lots and lots of crazy outfits, and you know, there was one area where there were like booths set up when you would hang out after the parade and you could walk around and you could go to a booth about something political or buy food or just hang out with your friends. But I had a motorcycle, and so I rode in Dykes on Bikes, and it was our job to lead off the parade, and it was like so awesome. The first year, it was really hard because we were riding up Market Street, and there's rail tracks. And so I was like, oh, trying to steer, because it was our job to get everybody excited. So we had to honk the horn, we had to wave, and I'm trying to drive on the tracks and honk the horn and wave. And, you know, and my friend, I had a friend go with me, and we dressed up. One year we dressed like Surf and Safari. So I wore a wetsuit, and she had a safari outfit, and she would make mimosas. So she'd be carrying mimosas, so we'd be drinking mimosas while we were driving in the parade and honking and waving. But the exciting part was there was this area where all the bikes would gather. And I would get up in the morning and I'd polish the bike and make sure it was all spotless and shiny, right? And you'd go and sit in this area and you'd be waiting for the parade to start. And then pretty soon you'd hear somebody would start their engine, and then more engines would start. And it was like, you could just feel this like swell of emotion and excitement. You know, it was awesome. And I think I always cried again when PFLAG would be in the parade, which was Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gays. And that, to me, was really touching, that these parents would put themselves out there and be in this parade. It was really cool.
So how many years did you participate in the parade?
I want to say 3 for sure, maybe 4.
Maybe 4?
Yeah.
Every time on the Dykes on Bikes?
Of course!
Of course.
Of course.
Did you
I want to say 4 times, because I did it 2 years, and then this other friend wanted to ride, and the one friend who did it with me the first 2 years was really pissed at me because I let this other friend ride. One year I wore a rainbow pinata on my head. That was like a mohawk.
Oh my gosh.
That was kind of hard to balance, but, you know.
You made it work.
It was fun. You put rainbow flags on the handlebars. It was great.
Did you ever go just to watch the parade or always in the parade?
Well, since we started out the parade, you know, then we would park our bikes and we got to basically see the whole parade afterwards because we let off the parade.
Okay.
And there were, I can't even tell you, hundreds of women on bikes. Hundreds. It was awesome.
So how did living in San Francisco compare to living in Lansing as far as the LGBTQ acceptance and pride?
Well, night and day. Here we're in this dark dive bar, hot, like sort of hiding away. There were certainly in Michigan today is still conservative in the ways that you know, I don't think a lot of people feel comfortable walking down the street holding hands with their girlfriend or boyfriend. So it was night and day. I don't know. You know, some things were similar, like, you know, lesbian softball teams, let's say. Okay. Here in Michigan, it was one of the few places where you could actually be with a group of lesbians in an acceptable environment. You know, there was a whole league, and, you know, you knew any softball game you went to, there was going to be lesbians there. You could, you know. And now today, I don't understand, because all these college teams, all these girls have long ponytails with bows in their hair, and I'm thinking, what? Where are the lesbians?
Maybe they just had to get more incognito.
I guess. I don't. But there's a perfect example of a difference. Like, you didn't have to be incognito there. You could just be you, whatever that was. So very different.
So when did you move back to Michigan?
Well, I first moved to San Diego.
Right.
And I lived there for 3 years. And that's what drove me back, because I know everybody says I'm crazy, but I didn't like the weather there. It was really boring. It was like, you know, there was no thunderstorms. There was no snow. You know, at least in San Francisco, you could go to Tahoe if you wanted snow. And it was different. San Diego's much more conservative. So there was a small gay community there. I don't even remember what it was called, because I don't think I really participated in it much. I don't remember there being a pride parade. There probably was, but I don't remember it. I just wasn't involved in the community there. And so I came back here in 80, no. I came back here in 92. I moved back to Michigan.
What brought you back?
Partly the conservative nature of the city, and I was missing my family.
And snow.
And snow. Yes. Where's the snow? It's December 3rd. Where's the snow?
That's what I've been saying.
So, yeah, that brought me back, and I'm on my fourth girlfriend, and she was from California. I met her in San Diego. And she moved back here with me, so, yeah, and she hated it here. Absolutely hated it here. The entire time we were here, and she was here for 19 years, 17 years, something. So, she's back in California now.
As long as she's happy, really.
Yeah, whatever.
When you came back to California, what was the community like? Like, how was it difficult for you to adjust to being from San Francisco, where everything's out in the open, to back in Michigan, where it's sort of
not
under the rug?
I had sort of a different approach than my partner did. She was disgusted by the whole thing. She's like, this is blah, 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 blah. Like, they did have a pride event in Royal Oak. It was in Royal Oak at the time. The first one we went to was held in the garage. The parking garage there, and then outside somewhere, I can't remember, and there were like 3,000 people. So, yeah, it was really different, 500,000 to 3,000. But I guess I was at the point where, for me, I didn't need that so much anymore. You know, I was comfortable where I was. I had found myself. I knew who I was. So I felt like it was our responsibility to educate people. Not that I would say, hi, Allie, I'm a lesbian, but I did it in a more sort of subtle way. Like, I would just talk about my partner. When people at work were talking about their husbands or their boyfriends, I would talk about my partner in the same way. And then they would say whatever or whatever. It doesn't matter to me.
Right.
I didn't care. My mom, when I was really young, my mom said to me, why do you feel you have to wear a lavender L on your forehead? And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, because to her, I was really out there. But, I was discovering myself then, and now I don't care.
Right. So you moved back to Michigan, and then you adopted your daughter?
Yes, not right away.
Right.
So we moved back in 92, adopted her in 2003. It was an interesting thing because my partner and I had talked about having children. How would we do that? At one point, we had asked her brother to donate sperm. Thank God that didn't happen. He was a guest. He never even answered the question because it was beyond his comprehension, but thank God that didn't happen that way because we would have been tied in a much deeper way. So adopting, we had gone to this party. I had this group of friends. We had this group of friends here. We had gone to a party and we met this woman. It was at her house. And she had adopted a daughter from China, and my partner had been talking to her about that. So after more people had left, what do you think about that idea? And I said, yeah, sounds great. And so how she described it was if you dropped a pebble in a pool and the ripples, and so it just grew into this thing. So because I'm really interested in research, I immediately after that party started researching how do we go about it. And it took us 18 months from the start of the paperwork to the time we went to China. But of course, Michigan doesn't or didn't at the time accept same-sex adoption. And China certainly didn't. So when we had to have social workers come to the house and talk to us here about all different kinds of things. I mean, I swear, straight people should have to go through what we had to go through to adopt. No, I mean, to have a child, anybody to have a child should have to go through that same process. They ask about religion, about money, about how are you going to raise the child, what kind of education do you want to give them, what kind of values, all of this stuff, all these questions. Anyway, to make a long story short, legally, only one of us could adopt. So legally, I was the adoptive parent. And when we went to China, and in fact, I had a friend who said, I think I told you before, the question on the form was, would you ever get married if the right man came along? Because I was having this moral conflict about not saying that, you know, I'm not straight. And I'm never going to be straight. But my friend said, do whatever you have to do to get your daughter. And so on that question, you know, would you ever marry a man if the right man came along? I thought, oh, I can answer that because I know the right man will never come along. So yes. So she, when we traveled to China, she had to be my traveling companion. And it was very funny because as soon as we got to China, there was another lesbian couple there. I mean, it was very obvious. I have very good gaydar. And they wouldn't have anything to do with us in the adoptive town where we went, in the province where we went, because, and my partner didn't want to do anything because they were afraid that the Chinese government wouldn't, you know, blah, 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 whatever. So when we finally left the province and we had, legally adopted according to the Chinese government, then we became close. And I'm actually friends with one of those women now. Our daughters are friends.
Delayed friendship.
Yes, it was very funny. It was very funny. But anyway, so that's what. And adopting my daughter, I mean, it was the best thing I've ever done, for sure.
What was it like in China?
Well, you know, you land there and you can tell you're in a communist country. there are guards, like government guards in the airports. The floors were spotless. You could eat off the floors in the airports. I mean, it was unbelievable. But we had a guide, a facilitator, who walked us through every part of everything. So we were just in awe. I mean, to think that we were going to become parents, that was the, you know, the initial thing. And everybody was really anxious. When are we going to meet our children? When are we going to meet our children? And then to have this baby, well, she was a year old, that you had to do everything for. She didn't know us. She didn't, you know, she didn't recognize the smells of us. We couldn't speak the language. And we had to try to become a family and get her to trust us. And while we were there was really something.
That just sounds...
It was exciting and overwhelming and wonderful and scary and all of that all at once, but I just fell right into it. It was...
Did you pick up any, like, Chinese phrases just to...
I had tried to learn a couple before we went, but it was more of a bonding thing. And I had done a lot of reading. Like I said, I do research, so I had read and read and read and been on listservs and of other adoptive parents to try to get as much information and make it as smooth as possible. And so I had bought this pack, a carrying pack, not a backpack, but one that was sort of a sling. And so I carried her everywhere the entire trip. I carried her. My ex did not, because she wasn't the parent, and so I had to have, and so that I think was a good thing because we bonded. You know, it wasn't not the first night, but it, you know, it was a gradual thing. But it's great.
Right.
It's great. Love her to pieces.
So, how do you feel about the LGBTQ movement and community in the past compared to what it is now? I'm sure your answer would have changed after the November 8th election, but.
Oh, well, okay. So before, you know, in the 80s, I was, you know, again, finding myself and just trying to immerse myself in all of it. When we moved here in the early 90s, I was involved with affirmations in Ferndale a little bit. Very disappointed that there's no wonderful gay bars to go dancing here, so that is probably my biggest angst here, because I like to dance and I'd love to go out and dance, but I don't want to go to a straight bar. Not interested in that. So as far as the movement is concerned, I've pretty much not been in it because I'm a parent. I mean, I have gone to Pride Fest and I've taken my daughter to Pride Fest, and actually what's really interesting is she is really interested in it now. She wanted to go this year, and she's in a club at school called Spectrum that is where 1 week somebody gave a presentation on historical figures in the LGBT community, and they're going to see the exhibition at the Cranbrook Art Museum on Edward Gorey because he was bisexual, and they're talking about transgender bathrooms. And so, you know, what have I seen in my lifetime in the movement, coming from having to be totally, not having to be closeted, but so many people being closeted, to now gay marriage? I mean, how fabulous was that? Like, you know, I had a lot of friends that got married, and yeah, gay rights has been the movement. You know, it's been a gradual, you know, it's like women's rights. We're not 100%. We don't get equal pay, and it's going to take a long time still, and our country wasn't ready for a woman president and all of that, but we've made a lot of strides. And I hope we can keep, yeah, it's going to be tough now.
Do you worry about it after the election results?
Not specifically. I worry about everything.
Okay.
I'm worrying about everything. I can't watch the news. I just, it's appalling to me. I have to say, though, you know about the safety pin, you know, wearing the safety pin and as like a safe harbor for people. For my birthday a few weeks ago, my daughter made me a safety pin with yarn in a rainbow. I should have worn it today. I should have worn it today, but I forgot to put it on. So that's pretty cool.
That's so nice.
And it's nice to have a kid who's interested and who is liberal-minded and can make a change. She'll be voting in the next election.
I think, though, you're also responsible for encouraging that liberalness because you're not putting her in this glass box of this is what you can do and can't do.
Yeah, well, it's a balance. You want to try to have your kid grow up to be what they want to be within sort of staying within some sort of framework. Like, I was nervous about her shaving her head. I thought that would be a little much, not only for her, but also, yeah, I am a little worried because of where she goes to school, of the reaction of people. I shouldn't be, and that's so not me. Like, I'm actually like I'll do things to get a reaction from people. And so this is my new struggle, like how do I manage this?
Your parenting.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, I don't know, will she be the one that is in the next LGBTQ movement? Maybe.
I think there's definitely another one coming.
Yeah, so I'm all for it. I'll be there supporting her. Will I be, riding in Dykes on Bikes again? Probably not. Sadly, maybe, though. I don't know. We'll see.
Yes, we will.